The Athletic.
I'm sorry, you can sit there and look and play with all your silly machines as much as you like.
Is Gascoigne going to have a crack? He is, you know. Oh, I say! Brilliant!
He's round the goalkeeper, he's done it! Absolutely incredible!
He launched himself 6 feet into the crowd and kung fu kicked a supporter who was without a shadow of a doubt giving him lip.
Does it tame and tame and tame again?
Crank up the music! Charge your glass! This nation is going to dance all night!
Pre-season woe, transfer window frustration, a want-away star, opening day deflation, getting dumped out of the Carabao Cup and losing the dressing room. Brought to your ears by The Athletic, this is Football Clichés and part one of the 12 stages of a club crisis. Hello everyone and welcome to episode 92 of the Football Clichés podcast. I'm Adam Hurry and with me for these crisis talks are, first of all, the man who follows crisis wherever it goes. It's Jack Pitbrook. How are you doing?
I'm looking forward to this podcast so much. I've been thinking about it all morning. It's going to be great fun.
Well, the thing about football crises, and I wanted to ask you this first, I feel like they're the most sustainable form of football story because good times never last. Transfer stories, as we all know, are kind of just vacuous. And matches, nobody really cares about those beyond, say, Monday lunchtime. So I feel like crises are the gift that keeps on giving. Like, they never stop, really, a crisis.
Yeah, crises define the form of the season. You know, you don't come out of a season and think, I love this season because I enjoyed watching these four teams. But you do think, this is the team, you know, Arsenal had a crisis, Everton had a crisis, Villa had a crisis, Newcastle had a crisis, Leeds had a crisis, West Brom had a crisis. And you, maybe this just makes you sound like a really negative person, but it's the crises that get you up in the morning. And it's the crises they're the last thing you think about before you go to sleep, Adam, and the first thing you think about in the morning.
Good. That's exactly why you're here. Thank God. Alongside you, for his Football Clichés debut, the man who adds a zero to the listening figures wherever he goes, it's Phil Hay.
Thank you for having me on, guys.
It's an absolute pleasure.
Sam Lee and I always joke with each other that we don't think we're funny enough to get on this show. Has Sam ever been on this?
He has, back in the dark days of early lockdown.
I was going to troll them a little bit later on. Crises, I think of them as my specialist subject. I always think that Chelino never phones you at 2 o'clock in the morning because they've beaten Barnsley 2-0 at home. It's because he's about to bullet David Hockaday or whoever's next.
Oh God, what a phone call that must be. But I mean, given your extensive knowledge of all forms of football in crisis, I put it to you that the threshold for a crisis is lower than ever. I mean, that's our fault to an extent, the media. But I just feel it doesn't take much anymore.
Well, there was a story this morning that Gillingham have had to cancel a Whitney Houston tribute act because of international call-ups. And I think that probably counts these days, don't you?
Yeah, definitely. What do we crack then? Like a Whitney Houston poster?
Yeah,
what gets cracked
great idea. Great idea. Keep an eye on the Mail Online.
Yes, exactly. The Masters.
Today. Yeah.
Yeah, the Masters of the badge crack. We have 12 stages of a club crisis to get through here. I think I've identified the levels that we have to go through for a full club crisis. So we start chronologically, really, with pre-season woe, Jack. Because pre-season is where the seeds of a club crisis are sown, I feel. Specifically, losing to some no-marks really does open these wounds.
I've drawn a lot of my examples from what I think is the crisis of, and genuinely the best story in the history of the Premier League.
Okay.
And that is what Antonio Conte famously called the Mourinho season, the Chelsea crisis from August to December 2015, where the reigning Premier League champions almost got themselves relegated and had to sack Mourinho. We've come close with Man United and Tottenham since. It's never, ever been as good. This is the original and the best crisis. And of course, it all started in pre-season. Chelsea famously lost to New York Red Bulls in July, which is absolute fodder for kind of there was a moment when look back pieces. And also there was an argument about the length and timing of the pre-season, which of course is classic. Like the roots of this problem started all the way back in June when Mourinho gave players an extra week's holiday and one fewer friendly. And it's the kind of bullshit thing that doesn't really explain what happened at all, but people can understand it. So they think it's they think that this point about the timing of the pre-season is the real story.
Right then, Phil. So pre-season is where a certain malaise can sit in, as Jack suggests. But certain frictions can kind of become more apparent there. But I feel like things can be sparked in pre-season, and that requires an incident. The first thing that I think of in a pre-season incident is Dennis Wise breaking Callum Davidson's cheekbone on a Leicester pre-season tour of Finland after, and I quote, a stormy card game.
Stormy card game. I had the delighted bit, Dennis Wise, for about a year and a bit. And I can imagine a stormy card game with him, and I can imagine it finishing incredibly well. I mean, you've never seen fear in somebody's eyes until you've seen Simon Grayson's Leeds lose 4-0 at Bury on a Tuesday night. But you see, if you've got anything about you in pre-season, you do what Leeds did in 2014, and that was the summer where David Hockaday was using a river as a surrogate ice bath, so he had the players sitting in it. But basically, they went over to Italy, and they managed to find the archetypal bunch of farmers, FC Gardena, and they beat them 16-0.
And then 60?
16.
6-0.
16-0, although I think...
Oh, okay, Jesus.
I think 60 was doable if they hadn't eased off in the second half. And then owing to contractual issues, inevitably, the team they were supposed to play from Romania didn't turn up. So they played each other. They played themselves. Leeds played themselves in the second friendly, which meant that they were able to return home gloriously undefeated and able to brush over the fact that at one point they hadn't paid for the training facilities and woke up to a sign saying you're no longer allowed to use these in the hotel. So that's the way to do it if you've got a crisis brewing. But yeah, breaking somebody's jaw, good sign.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, that's more than enough to spark a crisis. Out of interest, have either of you ever been to La Manga?
No.
Doesn't strike me as either your kind of scene, I have to say. But
I feel, though, that as a football writer, you should be there at least once in your career. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, rite of passage. Yeah, it's like, even, like Mecca.
Even if it's just for late warm weather training, you know, if they don't bother playing any games and they just head out at night, yeah.
You go any day, you go to La Manga any day between about start of June, end of July, Jack, there's a chance that you will witness some sort of pre-season incident involving Premier League players. It's the epicentre of this.
I imagine that it's one of those things that's been kind of pushed down the football ladder, basically, because now, you know, the big teams are off for International Champions Cup, or they're in Australia, or the Barclays Asia Trophy.
Yes.
And now I imagine that kind, you know, what I considered to be the traditional 1990s pre-season trip is probably now more of a, or at least pre-COVID, would have been more of a sort of championship thing. You know, warm weather training in the Austrian Alps, that sort of thing, with a big piss up at the end.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, the Alps. Why are they so obsessed with Swiss and Austrian training camps? Is it because they're really boring places, Phil? Is that?
But the Alps, it suggests a bit of tourism or a bit of, you know, kind of cultural intent. I think the thing about, you know, when you head to the Balearics or anywhere like that, you're just going for the Blue Wicked, aren't you? Blue Wicked definitely. And the paparazzi.
Absolutely.
Which is how it should be.
Yeah. I think all those trips I took to Baden-Baden, I should have swapped one out for La Manga just to mix it up. Okay, so pre-season set the scene. As I say, the wheels are in motion for our club crisis. We move on to stage two, which I think is becoming an increasing obsession in modern football, Jack, and that is recruitment / transfer window frustration. Managers seem to be losing control of this side of things, and they get very frustrated by the targets they've identified not being secured. It's palpable frustration, I sense.
It is palpable frustration. I was thinking really hard about examples of this, and I'm afraid to say all the examples I came up with involve Jose Mourinho.
Fine.
There's summer 2007 at Chelsea. He had some ludicrous list with like Xavi, Eto'o, and basically all the best players in the world at that point, and didn't land any of them. Summer 2015 at Chelsea, didn't get John Stones, Paul Pogba, Rafael Varane, did get Babar Rahman and Papi Djilobodji. Summer 2018 at Man United, didn't get Toby Alderweireld. Summer 2020 at Tottenham, didn't get Milan Skriniar. And then he just has this big sulk-on for all of the next season. It's, if only I had some good players. If only I had some good players.
Yes.
We should have got Mourinho on this. Maybe Chelino as well.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I know you've got their number, so surely that would have happened. But
dial them up, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, Papi Djilobodji, Jack, was very much the emblem of a frustrated transfer window, I sense. But that leads on inevitably, Phil, to a manager sending a message to the board. And I feel like this always happens in theory, or it's kind of presumed to be the case when it happens. But how does that manifest itself when a manager sends a message to the board with his team selection?
Well, one of two things tends to happen. Either the manager tries to send a message to the board, or he tries to toe the party line. And I always think that you know that things are getting out of hand on the recruitment front when you hear phrases like irons in the fire and we'll only sign the right players And things like they need to be better than what we've got after you finish 15th in the championship, that incredibly high bar. I think you send a message to the board by doing what Gary Monk did down at Sutton once, which was playing Paul Mackay and Billy Whitehouse, who, no disrespect to them, looked like your competition winners.
And saying, exactly,
you know, sign me some players, please. And sure enough, we got Mo Barrow and Alfonso Pedraza, God bless them.
It certainly can do.
It certainly can do. It depends on your owners. But I honestly think once you get into the realms of we'll only sign players if they're better than what we've got, you know that things are not going well.
Mm. Jack, I mean, to someone like me who doesn't know the really inner workings of how football clubs really work on a day-to-day basis, doing something as childish as like naming two keepers on your bench or putting a midfielder up front for the first game of the season, it's like the most childish thing a manager could do. Like, why don't you just go and actually have a proper chat with your owner rather than do this really weird public thing?
Yeah, but people in football aren't really childish and they do stupid and petty things as a matter of course.
Really petty.
Do you remember that famous, I mean, I don't want to call it, do you remember when Rafa Benitez famously gave a press conference where he used the phrase, I'm focused on training and coaching my team,
yes,
like 12 times after that's what I think Hicks and Gillette had told him to say. You know, I'm a huge fan of Rafa. I think that's very funny. It is also very petty. So I don't think football managers are necessary, you know, and even managers not as smart as Benitez, I don't think are necessarily beneath that kind of behaviour.
Exactly. It seems like he should be way above that sort of behaviour, unlike many other managers of film.
Well, Warnock's like at it up at Middlesbrough at the moment. He keeps getting asked about potential signings, and some of them he says, yeah, you know, that would be good. Some of them he says, well, if we're signing them, it's nothing to do with me. And you think, well, that's a good start. Yeah, sign on the dotted line here. But it is definitely true. And you do find those situations, particularly in press conferences, where little things get said where you think, a bit awkward behind the scenes here.
So recruitment, I mean, that is the kind of key word here now, Jack. It's not really signing players anymore. It's recruitment. It has become such an obsession that it has led to the rise of a slightly bland figure in my eyes, which is the sporting director, who have become this sort of oddly important figure, either in their actions or in their absence. But I put it to you that just the entire discourse around sporting directors, both in the UK and abroad, is the most boring thing in football. I'm almost inclined to say they're complete frauds, but I feel bad about that.
Yeah, it seems it's like the it's probably the big development in the last 5 years of you know, it's one thing to idolise Messi and it's another thing to idolise Guardiola, but for the true heads, they idolise Monchi or Paratici
exactly,
or whoever, and it's, you know, he
I don't think Monchi exists. I don't think Monchi/Monchi it actually exists.
Yeah, but at least with Guardiola, with Messi, it's obvious what he's good at, and then with Guardiola, it's fairly obvious what he's good at. But when it comes to these guys, the argument's like he watches DVDs 24/7. He never sleeps. All he does is take notes. And he watches players 1,000 times before he signs them. But sometimes he only needs to watch them once, and then he'll just know.
Exactly.
It's just like, how you get excited by this? This is meant to be fun.
I think if Jukanović is listening to this, he'll concur. He was someone who always made it sound like he wanted to fight Fulham's sporting director constantly. You know, irrespective of who they signed or how well it was going, it always sounded like they were one step away from stepping outside. I mean, on the subject of sporting directors, you might have to fight Victor Orta.
I thought you might bring him up. Your best mate.
Especially having slated Monchi over at Sevilla. I'm warning you now. I think Orta is like the Conor McGregor of sporting directors. He'd definitely say you and me pub car park 7 o'clock tonight. I think we should make it happen.
I happily. I mean, I was happy for you to kind of debunk this all sporting directors are frauds theory, because that's fine. I didn't have much to stand it up with. But I mean, until I really dig into this sort of thing, I thought the job of a sporting director consists of only two things. One, smiling awkwardly at UEFA draw ceremonies. Mm-hmm. And two, posing with academy graduates who are putting pen to paper on their first professional contract. Nothing else is required of you, except maybe, fundamentally, you're just a plant to get the manager annoyed so you can sack him.
Yeah, you also have the bonus of being able to walk through town in most situations without anybody knowing who on earth you are.
Faceless.
But then also you have this weird scenario where because nobody really understands what you do, sometimes you become the target for the crowd. You know, people just decide that this guy in the background must be causing the problems. Let's berate him, even though we couldn't point him out in the street.
It's just massively intangible elements required to do that job.
Oh yeah, isn't it? Yeah, no, I agree. Yeah.
Mm. I'm tempted to try and take my sporting director badge.
There's a long read coming on here.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. The Athletic sent Adam Harrow to become a sporting director at a League One club and see how far up they'd...
After a fallout with Neil Warnock.
Yeah, how many managers can I unsettle? That would be the key.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
So, speaking of unsettled, Jack, and I know this is your recent specialist subject, the next kind of optional extra in a burgeoning club crisis is the want-away star. I feel like it really does enhance a crisis in its early stages because they rarely resolve quickly, they're quite tedious, and they really stretch the whole thing out.
As someone who spent the last few months covering a story like this, they are astonishingly tedious. A good crisis often starts with the player wanting to leave. Even just looking at the team that I cover, Tottenham, yeah, particularly at the start of the season, Gareth Bale 2013, Luka Modric 2011, and again 2012, Dimitar Berbatov 2008. You need them, you know, the kind of will he, won't he, is he in training, he's not in a fit state to play, ask the player asking not to play, that kind of thing. It's manager getting flustered, getting questions about why exactly it's happened. It just adds to the air of things are not right here. And of course, it's the kind of thing that doesn't really happen to the very, you know, biggest and most successful teams generally. Don't have their best players trying to force an exit at the start of the season. And of course, it disrupts the whole planning. So yeah, it's very much a kind of a classic part of the rich tapestry of a crisis.
Phil, a question for you then. If the saga of a want-away star does end up going the way that the club wants, what will that player eventually start doing?
Yeah, well, we're talking about Harry Kane here, aren't we? Which is unfortunate because I can't really imagine Harry Kane throwing chairs or smashing the place up. But I agree that these sagas become more and more boring as they go on. And you go from the initial thought of, they're going to leave, to, look, please just sort this out. One way or the other, just do something. I mean, I'm kind of far more interested at the moment at looking at all the weird pictures of Charlie Kane rather than Harry Kane, who I'd never even really heard of before.
Yeah,
to be quite honest.
It's been a big time for Charlie Kane, the guy who looks a little bit like Harry Kane, definitely.
Yeah, very much so. I think there are levels of this. If you're Harry Kane, you probably cause a little bit of mischief, but it's not in the grand scheme of things. You know, Tottenham will still have him back in 30 years' time when they need somebody on the pitch. I think if you all had youth, there's the potential for more trouble there. Harry Kane, I think, is a kind of high-level quality footballer, but low-level want-away star because of the lack of friction that there'll be from it, you know.
The answer you were, in fact, looking for was knuckling down. Oh, that's what we want Harry Kane
to do. Which he did last night in the Europa Conference League. Well, I mean,
does that qualify as knuckling down?
How better to knuckle down than to notch twice against Paços de Ferreira FC
after
a 3-0 win, putting your team through to the Europa Conference League group stage?
Yeah, the literal opposite of downing tools.
Top
is scoring a brace against Paços de Ferreira.
Well, if you're going to down tools, that's the time, really, isn't it? You know, nobody's going to hold it against you.
Yeah.
Given that Spurs are trying to get out of that competition, surely.
Definitely you want to down tools in a competition that the BBC website won't even include on their results section.
Maybe that's his protest that he's keeping them in it.
Because he's sending a message to the board but saying, I'm still, you still need me.
As long as you hold on to me, we're going to be playing in this conference league.
Yeah, exactly. So, once-away star is very much a separate crisis, perhaps, but I still feel a vital ingredient. So that's stage three. I'll move you on now, Phil, to stage four. A less important aspect, but still I feel adds a little bit of spice, which is the opening day defeat. Because it sets the tone. Because opening days are supposed to be hope and dreams. But if you lose your opening day, especially in a particularly spectacular way. I'm thinking Manchester United losing against Aston Villa in 1995, which obviously didn't turn out to be a crisis. Or Chelsea losing to Burnley on the first day of their title defence in 2017. There's a unique sense of chaos about losing on the opening day, is what I'm trying to say.
Oh, yeah. I'm thinking Leeds away at Southampton in 2011, and you knew that the promotion bid was already going well when the crowd were singing to Bates, "You Chelsea bastard, get out of our club," at 3-0 down. Oh, yeah. Great. No, but that has to follow, I think, a depressing summer. So that was the summer where a few weeks earlier Leeds had been turned over at Burnley. And I think the first signing of the summer had been Paul Rehubka from Blackpool. Yeah. And a second choice keeper was definitely what was needed to improve that team. I think that is absolutely fundamental part of the crisis. It's got to go badly from the start.
Mm. But the thing with an opening day defeat, Jack, is that obviously it's the kind of everything that's gone wrong in pre-season comes to fruition in this public display of ineptitude. Your new signings, whether they've actually arrived or not, haven't impressed. But unfortunately, you have to assume that fans haven't turned up to the opening day with their banners yet. So even the fans are unprepared for this.
The classic one I've got written down here is actually an opening day draw. Okay. And this is from the Mourinho season, like one of the best examples. Chelsea 2, Swansea City 2, 2015-16 season, the Ibercanero row game.
Oh, yes.
Which yes. Very much set the tone for all the madness that was to come in the next 5 months at Chelsea, but was not itself a defeat. If you want a classic shock defeat in which the team plays very badly and it's clear they're going to be shit all season, it can only be Arsenal 1, Paul Lambert's Aston Villa 3.
Oh, I also had that, yes.
Antonio Luna, I think, might even have scored twice. This was a few weeks before Arsenal signed Mesut Ozil. Their only summer signing was Yaya Sanogo. 60,000 Arsenal fans singing, "Spend some fucking money." Classic, 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 late era Wenger, Arsenal in this perma-crisis that lasted from about 2010 to 2018. And this was
My abiding memory of that game was one Villa goal scorer having just the entirety of the Arsenal half to himself.
Antonio Luna, yeah.
Yeah, right, yeah. I mean, yeah, hasn't done anything else in his career other than being the symbol of an early season Arsenal crisis. So, yeah, basically a little bit of seasoning for a crisis, but not absolutely crucial. But Phil, I would put it to you that the next one is very much the cornerstone of a good crisis. If this doesn't happen, you can't really call it a crisis. And that's the Carabao Cup upset.
Oh, now, you see, I don't know, because I was looking at your tweets earlier in the week when you were predicting badly the results of the second round. Yeah, yeah. Although you did get 3-0 leads against Crewe, so good on you. But you were saying about, I think, Norwich-Bournemouth. You said it'll be a Bournemouth win. People will half-heartedly call it an upset, but nobody cares. Mm. And I kind of think that's where we are with the League Cup these days. I don't know. It doesn't scream crisis to me, because there are all manner of way in which you can deflect and disguise and pretend that you weren't actually trying, really, wouldn't you?
Well, I mean, yes, you're absolutely right on paper. But this is the thing about a crisis. We will take any kind of opportunity we can to turn the screw. So even if it is like a 10 changes, 18-year-old up front defeat against a team who happens to be one division below you, doesn't matter. It's artificial crisis deepening. It's the Canderel in the football crisis tea, isn't it? It doesn't matter, because no one will remember what the team selection was. They'll just remember that you lost in the third round of the Carabao Cup against a team who are a division below you. That's all that matters.
Well, I suspect after Colchester battered Norwich with Brian Gunn, do you remember that? I can imagine the Carabao Cup the week after that. It would have been, what, the Carling Cup back then? I can imagine that being a bit tetchy. Yeah, sort of thing that could drag you down, although I suspect he'd gone by then, had he not?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, that was definitely hapless.
I mean, that was season ticket throwing day. And it has to be said that, if we're talking crises, that is that's peak crisis, that.
Oh, we're getting onto season ticket throwing in depth later on. But yeah, I mean, yeah, the Carabao, Jack. I mean, I suppose there is an opportunity, alternatively, the Carabao does offer you the opportunity of a crisis, what crisis moment, which is equally artificial, equally bullshit.
It does. I wanted to take this opportunity to mention what I think a classic crisis we haven't touched on yet, which is the crisis that was Roy Hodgson's Liverpool, who delivered one of the great, what was then the Carling Cup upsets, going out on pens at home to Northampton. At Anfield, and the team with Jones, Agger, Kyriakos, Danny Wilson, Martin Kelly, Danny Pacheco, Lucas, Spearing, Jovanovic, Ryan Babel, and David Ngog. And this
I hate how much research Pip Brook has done here.
It's incredible.
What I love about the Hodgson crisis is that it's like a big, it's a big club crisis, but there was, I kind of feel like with the big Chelsea crises, the fans didn't really turn on Mourinho in either instance that much. Maybe because of the credit he had in the bank with them, I'm not sure. Whereas the Liverpool fans' hatred of Roy Hodgson gave an extra spice to the Hodgson crisis. Plus, of course, the owners, Hicks and Gillette, it was a really bad time for the club in general. But it's a Hodgson at Liverpool is definitely a classic crisis.
I think as well, that's a good example of how the scale of crises differ. And I always think that, it's at its worst when the crowd can't decide who to hate most, whether it's the players or whether it's the owner, whether it's the coach. I've seen a few of them at Leeds. And you're right about Hodgson. I suspect not the players, but between him and the board, it was a case of who do we throw tomatoes at?
Phil, that's now called the Everton dilemma.
Well, I mean, it precipitates a crisis if the manager has basically no money in the bank with the fans from the start. I mean, we're not talking about a club legend here. So Hodgson was kind of on a hiding to nothing, presumably.
Yeah, he really was.
So let's set the scene. We've had a woeful pre-season. Transfer window targets have not been secured. Your biggest player wants to leave. You've lost on the opening day. You've probably gone out the Carabao Cup as well. So that all leads to perhaps the core of a club crisis. The real turning point, the business end begins here, Phil, and that's dressing room unrest. The dressing room is a concept. The first thing I think of when I hear the phrase losing the dressing room is just a manager sort of stood there having done, a week's worth of preparation for a game. He's sleeping in the office, working around the clock to try and turn this around, and none of the players are listening to him. It's like just having loads of two-year-olds not doing what you're telling them.
I sort of more imagine that he comes in to talk to the dressing room and it's really quiet and nobody's giving him eye contact. And when he asks questions, like that thing at school when you're all in trouble, nobody bothers answering. It's like, just everyone keep quiet and eventually he'll go away. But you're right, there has to be dressing room unrest. Otherwise, clubs are just able to paint this picture of unity, which nobody believes, but you can't, you can't contradict it because you don't have somebody who's desperately trying to get the manager sacked and grassing on him to the owner. So I have pictures of everybody just staring at the floor as he's trying to do this Churchillian speech and people going, come on, jog on, mate.
Jack, can you imagine how crushing it must be to have everyone who works underneath you just not giving a shit about anything you say?
I know, knowing that they don't care and knowing that they don't need to care. And just when you think about it like that, I imagine that the situations where the players are really invested in what the manager says, that sounds like a much more rare thing, doesn't it? To have what we've just described is surely much more common within football than having a kind of Klopp, Pochettino, Guardiola, Bielsa type situation where the players are hanging on the manager's every word. That now strikes me as being really kind of fantastical.
Yeah, what managers want is this, the dream scenario where the players, sort of in their autobiographies about 15 years later, say, do you know what? Everything he said about the match came true. He said we were going to win 1-0 from a corner in the 23rd minute, and we did. We couldn't believe it. That's what a manager wants. That's the dream scenario. Again, it's pretty much Mourinho.
I remember a few of the players at Leeds saying that Hockaday used to talk a lot about the Croods. I've never seen the film, but something to do with like family unity and this, that. They all used to sit about and go, what the fuck is this guy on about?
Weird techniques from managers never seem to go down well. Unless, of course, when they do and they win and then they become this kind of quirky, cool thing that they did to win a round. So you really can't win as a manager.
It's like just permanently balancing on the cliff, isn't it? And eventually that stuff is going to lead to...
So we've established now that, losing a dressing room is obviously quite easy, Jack. And what spills out of this is the questioning of managers' methods. Now, there are some very precise things that get questioned. I talked about this on the podcast before, but it's an obsession of mine. Ketchup. If you were a Premier League player, do you want ketchup or do you not want ketchup? Do you care?
The correct answer to that is the opposite of what the last guy did. If the last manager was a ketchup guy, it's no ketchup. If the last manager was a no ketchup guy, it's ketchup.
What a huge moment that must be in the team canteen, Phil. If you are indeed working in there, bit proudly pouring out the ketchup into the receptacle.
You keep it in the cupboard and it's a sign of protest that when it comes
it
out, you're saying to the manager, right, you've had it now, we're back on this. They tell me that footballers like sweet chilli sauce as well, and I have to be honest, I've never looked at the nutritional value on the back of the bottle, but that can't be good for you, is it?
That's full of sugar.
Maybe that is the ultimate protest. You know, yeah. And players get on the sweet chili sauce, like, right, yes. You know, had enough.
I want to see sweet chili sauce in an Athletic long read headline before the end of this year.
Consider it
much,
done.
Much sexier than ketchup, for a start.
The questioning of methods is always, it's basically the inverse of that stage at the start of the season when a team's doing well and everyone's trying to find out why they're doing well. Everyone does these stories which are saying, you know, yoga, handshake and WhatsApp banter, how manager A has reinvigorated Team X's season. And then when they're in a crisis, like, you know, they've got out the Carabao Cup and everything, it's just the inverse of that, isn't it? It's how no yoga, no handshakes and no WhatsApp banter has sunk Team X's season.
Yeah, absolutely.
No. It'd be like this with Bielsa. It'll be my pieces of how, you know, endless training has made Leeds this incredible team, and then at the end how and relentless training has left them completely fucked.
This is
and
it.
Bit, yeah. You know, like,
Leeds are going to be in crisis inevitably. I mean, Leeds are due a crisis clearly, Phil, but their 2022-23 crisis will be Calvin Phillips can't handle Bielsa's workload anymore. He's sick of it.
And
works
even if,
too
even
hard.
If that's not true, that's what we'll write anyway, because it's just easier that way. I mean,
sounds
to
good.
Be honest, Leeds out of crisis is, and I know none of us have experience of this, but it's a bit like retiring to the Caribbean, where suddenly you need to acclimatise to, you know, not being on edge constantly and Chileno, you know, not ringing you at 2 a.m.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, yeah, you can work your players too hard. You can work your players too little in Mourinho at Spurs' case, Jack.
Yeah, well, I was going to say that was a classic example. Was the under almost exactly what Phil just said. Under Pochettino, the hard work made Spurs good, but until the hard work made Spurs bad, and then with Mourinho, the kind of relaxed attitude to training made Spurs good, until the relaxed attitude to training made Spurs bad. So basically, I mean, look, I hope I haven't undermined the whole, you know, principle of football journalism in an instant, but
possibly
it does. You know, let he who has not written a trivial story where getting pointless details to explain greater trends cast the first stone.
I think what you're saying is you can understand why a lot of managers would like to fight us.
Yes. Bottle of ketchup in hand. I want to see a graph of complicated medical cardiovascular data of footballers alongside a line of ketchup consumption. And I bet one day we'll find that they actually tally up or are inversely proportional. And that will be the key to all football crises forever. Well, we've disgraced ourselves in La Manga, we've fallen out with our fashionable sporting director, we've cracked our badge, we've downed our tools, we've crashed out of the Carabao, and we've lost our tomato ketchup. That's it for part one of the 12 stages of a club crisis. We'll be back with you on Thursday with our laminated A4 banners of protest for part two. See you then.
The Athletic.